From the studios of KPCW in Park City, Utah, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, well, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our first guest this morning is Professor Russell Foster, who has written Lifetime, Your Body Clock, and Its Essential Roles in Good Health and Sleep. It's a guide to using the science of the body clock to promote better sleep, better health, and better thinking. We look forward to our conversation with Russell.
Our second guests this morning are National Geographic explorers Steve Winter and Sharon Guinup. Their new book is The Ultimate Book of Big Cats, Your Guide to the Secret Lives of These Fierce, Fabulous Felines.
Lions and tigers, oh my. Well, these two guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest this morning is Professor Russell Foster, who is a fellow at Brasenose College. He's also the director of the St. Jules Thorne Sleep and Circadian Neuroscience Institute, and he's the head of the Nuffield Laboratory of Ophthalmology at the University of Oxford. Russell has just written Lifetime, Your Body Clock, and Its Essential Roles in Good Health and Sleep. It's a guide to using the science of the body clock to promote better sleep, better health, and better thinking. Professor Foster, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning, John. Absolutely delighted to join you.
Well, we are delighted to have you on the program. Your book has a lot of buzz, and with 30, 40 years of real hard science and research that you have done, this is chock full of a lot of really good information. So let's start with this. The 24-hour clocks, they affect everything from mental health, risk of cancer, obesity, and it appears that sleep is at the key to all of this. What is the current thinking about sleep?
Well, it's a really important question. And there are a variety of different explanations. My view isn't universal. My belief is that sleep is essentially a time of inactivity where we do not move within an environment to which we are poorly adapted, but during which time we undertake a myriad of essential bits of biology, whether it be memory formation. And the extraordinary thing, it's not just the consolidation of facts, but we're actually processing information whilst we're asleep. If you want to come up with innovative solutions to complex problems, a night of sleep has now been shown to hugely enhance your capacity to do that. We also know from recent studies that whilst we sleep, toxins in the brain, and there's a really very important misfolded protein called beta amyloid, which is packaged up and cleared from the brain. And it's high levels of beta amyloid that have been associated with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. In a sense, you can think of the quality of one's sleep as defining the quality of one's wake. They are yin and yang of our existence.
Yeah, and certainly the human brain is intelligent. We know that. And we've also learned over the years that it's a distributed architecture, that there's intelligence in every cell of the body that communicates with the brain and communicates with other cells. And reading your book, it was fascinating that there's not only a central clock in the brain, but every cell in our body has a clock that synchronizes with that master clock. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So part of the pivotal work that showed that there is a master clock within the brain was undertaken by Martin Ralph and Mike Menaker at the University of Virginia. And in fact, I was with them and contributed to those discoveries. And so what we thought was there was this master clock ticking away in the brain and forcing rhythmicity on the rest of the body, whether it be hormonal changes, behavioral changes, you name it. And then it was discovered that these special clock genes are not just found within this master clock, this suprachiasmatic nuclei, but in every cell in the body. I thought, oh, yeah, well, they're probably doing something different. And then I remember being at the meeting when the first demonstration that peripheral clocks, basically any clock you care to talk about, it has the capacity to generate a circadian rhythm. So you've got this extraordinary hierarchy, whereby the master clock is then regulating, but not driving, billions and billions of cellular oscillators throughout the organ systems of the body to coordinate, to orchestrate a beautiful physiology and behavior. And it really is one of the great achievements, I think, in neuroscience.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Professor Russell Foster. He's just written Lifetime, Your Body Clock and Its Essential Roles in Good Health and Sleep. Okay, Professor Foster, so if our organs and every cell in our body has their own sort of internal circadian rhythm, and if those aren't linked up, and that's what we're hoping the master clock does, but what I think I'm hearing you say is if we get really poor sleep, our organs aren't linked up, so our liver might not be linked up to rid itself of toxins while we sleep if things are thrown off. Is this what you're getting at?
Well, kind of. I mean, one of the really important things to ensure that we have this coordination across the entire sort of time domain of our bodies is that the eye detects the light-dark cycle. And in fact, I was very much involved in the discovery of new photoreceptors, new light sensors within the eye that set the master clock within the brain. And the key thing is that if you don't have that daily exposure to the light-dark cycle, then you begin to drift. The circadian system then begins to sort of fall apart. And I've likened it to rather like an orchestra. You know, in a beautifully aligned orchestra, all the musicians are playing the right notes at the right time. But in the absence of that coordinating cue, the orchestra starts to drift apart. And so instead of having a glorious symphony, you have this cacophony of sound. And that's a bit like what goes on in our biology. It begins to drive things apart. And of course, what we need to do is to get the right materials to the right organs and tissues at the right concentration at the right time. And that's how our biology works. And that's what this extraordinary time stamping up by the circadian system does to our biology. In the absence, things fall apart. And we have what's called internal desynchrony, where things aren't beautifully aligned and we can't do the right thing at the right time.
I like that. Internal desymphony. I'm going to write that down. Okay, so one of these things, when we do have internal synchronization of our systems, is we rid ourselves, you talked a moment ago about the beta amyloids in our brain. Mm. And if those are not dumped at night when our body and our brains recover through good sleep, then we are predisposed for dementia or Alzheimer's later on in life. Can you into that a little bit more and sort of explain between those people who only regularly get 5 hours of sleep and those who get nine?
Yeah. Okay. So a really good sort of set of questions. I guess the first thing to point out is there's been a certain amount of misinformation about how much sleep we need. And we're often heard about the mantra, you know, you have to have 8 hours. But sleep is very much like shoe size. One size does not fit all. The National Sleep Foundation's recommendation is around about 7 to 8 hours, but the range is between 6 hours and some people need 10 or 11 hours. And the key thing for each of us is to identify how much sleep we need as individuals and then organize our lives around that to prioritize sleep. And it's kind of straightforward. It's the sort of thing our grandparents would have told us. You know, if you're feeling able to function optimally during the day, if you don't crave caffeinated drinks, if you are interacting with your family, friends, work colleagues in an appropriate way, if you're not oversleeping on free days or indeed on holidays, then you're probably getting the sort of, you know, these are the things that tell us that you're getting the right amount of sleep or not. And of course, the other thing is that our sleep demands change as we age. And of course, there are genetic influences. So how long we sleep and the sleep timing, our chronotype, whether you're a lark or an owl, is to some extent influenced by our genetics. So this huge variation, and the first thing we've got to do is work out what works best for us, and then, of course, try and defend those behaviors. And you know, people have come up to me pre-COVID, I was sort of doing lots of public talks, and one chap said to me, you know, I don't get 8 hours of sleep. Am I going to die? And I said, well, I can assure you, you're going to die, but it may have nothing to do with the fact you're not getting 8 hours. And I think it's really fascinating because, you know, in the 80s, everybody sort of thought sleep was like some illness that need a cure. Then we went to the stage of, yeah, sleep's kind of important. And now we're completely terrified if we don't get the sleep we think we need. So there's a lot of misinformation from sleep apps. They are pretty inaccurate. And again, lots of people get very distressed about the messages they get from those sleep apps. Another really important fact is sleeping through the night. We're all told you must get 8 hours of consolidated sleep. But the natural state of sleep in humans, as described so beautifully from historical records from Roger Eckert, and then later in the lab by Tom Weir, has shown that the normal state of human sleep, given the opportunity, is to go to sleep. There's a slow winding down. Go to sleep for a few hours. Wake up. You may be awake for half an hour or more. And then you go back to sleep again. You wake up again, and then you go back to sleep. And what's happening at the moment is that people will wake up, they think, oh my goodness, I'm never going to get back to sleep, start getting stressed, anxious, then start drinking coffee, doing emails. If they're just relaxed, maybe not lie in bed, but go to another room quietly, read, listen to a piece of music that you enjoy, you will go back to sleep. And we've got to sort of, I think, take ownership of one's sleep and not be terrified of it.
Wow, that's interesting. Professor Foster, can we talk about light? You mention in your book that natural light is important for sleep, and there's morning light and there's afternoon light. If someone goes to bed at 10, they usually get up at 6, but the last couple of weeks they've been getting up at 4, or they wake up at 4 and have trouble getting back to sleep. Should they get more natural light in the morning and less in the afternoon, or the other way around?
It's a really, again, fascinating question, John. And light has different effects at different times. So morning light makes you get up earlier and go to bed earlier the next day, whereas dusk light delays the clock, makes you go to bed later and get up later the next day. When we're all agricultural workers, and of course, until fairly recently we were, we got symmetrical exposure to morning and dusk light. So the clock was being nudged forward and back in a symmetrical manner. And what's happening in our modern society is that we may only get partial exposure to one bit of daylight. We did a study a few years ago on university students around the world, and we showed those with the latest chronotype, the more owl-like they were missing morning light in the morning, which would have made them get up earlier, but getting lots of late afternoon light, which of course makes them get up later. So part of our morningness and eveningness depended upon our genetics and how old we are, but also because of when we see light. And I think that is something that we can take control of. So if you are a late type, but you've got to get up for work in the morning, then what you can do is set the alarm, and it's brutal. If it's winter, you may need to sit in front of a light box. If it's summer, then you can get outside, get that morning light, and it will advance the clock and make you get up earlier. So it depends upon what you want to do. Most of us tend to need more morning light than evening light. But there are some people, about 10% of people, who would need more evening light.
So advancing the clock would get you up earlier. So if you...
That's right.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So that morning light gets you up earlier. So if you're struggling, then as soon as you can, get that morning light. Have your breakfast by a window. Get outside. It's really interesting. A study showed that some really good, the people who have a dog are really have pretty good sleep. And of course, it's probably because they've got to get out of bed, walk the dog, they get that morning light exposure. The clock is then stable, which then influences a stable sleep-wake cycle.
I worked my way through college working on a graveyard shift from 12 until 8 in the morning, midnight till 8, and sometimes I get overtime till 9 or 10, and that was brutal. But the common belief is that over time, a person will be able to adopt to a night shift, a graveyard shift. And you debunk that, and you have actual research on that. Can you tell us about that?
Well, absolutely. And so I remember chatting to the chairman of the Confederation of British Industry a few years ago. And he was sort of giving this speech saying, we can run, you know, Britain on a 24/7 basis. And we won't have a huge great commute. We won't need to build expensive buildings. You know, we can just use it round the clock. And here was a bright man, you know, trying to find a solution, but had no idea of the biological consequences of what he was saying. And the thing is, 97% of shift workers don't adapt to the night shift. And we have to ask the question, why? I mean, if you travel across multiple time zones, we do adapt to the appropriate time zone and we go back to light. What's going on, of course, is that in the factory, in the workplace, at night, there's relatively dim light. And then on the drive home, you're exposed to morning light, as you were, John, when you finished your shift. And the clock will always defer to the brighter light signal as being daytime. Of course it is. And so the clock does not shift. So the great problem of a night shift worker is their entire biology is saying you need to be asleep. And so we're struggling against that. And part of the way that we cognitively essentially override this need for sleep is to activate the stress axis. Now, stress is wonderful short term. It's a bit like first gear in a car. It gives you that wonderful acceleration. But if you leave the engine in first gear, the engine falls apart. And that's what's happening on the night shift. Essentially, people are driving their stress axis on full throttle. And of course, it's distorting physiology and making you more vulnerable to diabetes 2, obesity, massive metabolic problems, cardiovascular disease, and even increases the risk for cancer. Studies on night shift nurses a few years ago have shown high rates of colorectal cancer and breast cancer, to the extent that the World Health Organization has stated that night shift work is a probable carcinogen.
Wow, that's huge. And this is the first time that I have heard this discussion. It also makes me wonder, Russell, here in Park City, we have, because Salt Lake City is a big Delta Airlines base, we have a lot of people who work in the airlines. And at least one friend of mine, a pilot, who flew internationally, you know, they're, unlike a night shift worker, they are constantly being thrown into different time zones. Maybe we go to India once, and then we go to Europe, and then we're here and there. And he just felt like it wreaked so much havoc on his internal systems that he was so happy when he retired. And I just thought, oh, you know, your circadian rhythm must just get accustomed to upset. But what would you suggest to those pilots? I mean, I guess turning on the bright lights in the cockpit or something when it's supposed to be daytime.
It's really tricky. And you know, there's been some very interesting studies on aircrew and airline pilots. So female aircrew, for example, circadian rhythms are intimately associated with the menstrual cycle. And there's huge disruption of circadian rhythms. And so menstrual cycles can get very badly disrupted. And infertility is a problem. High rates, incidentally, is a study on Canadian long-haul pilots, high rates of prostate cancer in those individuals. And studies comparing short-haul versus long-haul have shown that cognitive decline, one's ability to process information, is worse after 5 years of long haul versus short haul. What you can do about it is pretty minimal, I have to say, because there aren't drugs at the moment that shift the clock. Interestingly enough, we're working on some. Melatonin is very mildly effective, if at all. And of course, it becomes very difficult because you don't know where the clock is. If you've done multiple trips backwards and forwards, let's say across the Atlantic or across the Pacific, the clock is in lots of different places. So even if we had a drug, it's not clear when you take it. So it's a real issue. And I think it's very important that not only airline pilots, but our night shift workers in general need to know the consequences. So, you know, irritability, anxiety, it's worth bearing in mind that in some sectors, the divorce rate is 6 times higher in night shift workers compared to day shift workers doing the same job. So poor memory consolidation, poor communication skills, reduce social connectivity. And so we've got to let people know what they're taking on. But I don't want to sort of give the message of endless doom and gloom. I think there are things that we can do. And I think there's a duty of care that is being appreciated by employers towards their employees. So, for example, knowing there are higher rates of obesity, diabetes 2, coronary heart disease, what food do we make available to our night shift workers? Well, it's fast food, high fat, high sugar. What we should be providing is easy to digest, protein-rich snacks. And I don't know of any sector that's actually doing that. Knowing there's a greater chance of falling asleep at the wheel after the night shift, and there's a study in the UK showing that 57% of junior doctors after the night shift on the drive home had either had a crash or a near miss. We should be providing those apps which detect if you've got a head roll or your car is swerving to alert you that you're falling asleep at the wheel. There's a bunch of stuff that we could do, and at the moment we're not. And I really hope that employers, employees get together to iron out some of these issues before it becomes litigious and there are class action suits, which will then destroy any sensible dialogue.
Oh, that's so interesting. Russell, I've always wondered this. If I, for example, well, first of all, I'm one of those people that in the wintertime I could probably go to bed at 7:30, and I always want to, but I force myself to stay up. And then when I go, for example, to Europe, you know, an 8-hour time difference, once I get adjusted to the time over there, which, as you say, takes about one day per hour of time zone difference, which is interesting. Yep. I kind of pretend to myself that it only takes me a day if I just stay awake until, you know, a decent time at night. But once I get adjusted, I still want to go to bed there at 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the wintertime, whatever it is.
Absolutely, because that's the way you're wired. I mean, you know, you're a morning person. And in fact, morning people find it easier to fly to Europe, to fly from the States east, than the other way around. I mean, I'm a late type. And so flying to the States for me was easy, really easy. I would adapt quickly. So it depends, again, on to some extent in your chronotype. And then after a while, you adapt, you adopt the same relationship with a light-dark cycle that you had, depending upon where you came from.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Professor Russell Foster, who has written a fascinating book, Lifetime, Your Body Clock and Its Essential Roles in Good Health and Sleep. Professor, I was reading over the weekend about the neonatal intensive care units where the lights are pretty much always on. And you mentioned that there's increasing evidence that providing a light dark cycle for preterm babies in the neonatal intensive care unit has significant benefits, including increased weight gain and reduced stay in the hospital compared to infants that get light all the time. And I sent mail to a friend of mine who is in Oslo, Norway, who works at one of these facilities. And she told me that their lights are on 24/7. And that she's going to talk to the director, and she's buying a copy of your book, and she's going to try to spread the love over there.
Yeah, I think it's such an important thing, and it raises the very important question: is why don't we take sleep circadian rhythms more seriously within the medical domain? And I've had long discussions with my medical cover families members, and there are two reasons. One is it's not embedded within the training. Most medical doctors will have, during their training, may have one or two lectures on this subject, and it won't be the sort of stuff you'll find in Lifetime. And the second thing is our healthcare professionals are so, their jobs are so intense. I mean, the expression is they're running as fast as they possibly can to stay where they are. If we then ask them to do certain things at certain times, it just makes the administration, the practice, so overwhelmingly complicated. I think the attitudes are changing, and you know, knowing, for example, that drugs at different times will have different effects. So, for example, chemo and radiotherapy, some wonderful stuff by Bill Horesky, who showed that same drugs, same concentration, different times for ovarian cancer, after 5 years, there was 45% survival versus a 10% survival in the other time group. And these data are now spreading through the medical profession. They're beginning to think, how can we incorporate this in our training? And in, more importantly, how can we incorporate this stuff in our practice? It's going to take a bit of time, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
And the rest of the animal kingdom and bacteria and everything on this planet, are we all driven by a clock?
That was the great surprise. We kind of thought that, oh, well, you had to be a multicellular creature to have some sort of circadian clock. And now all the major groups of organisms on the Earth have been shown to have the capacity to generate an internal circadian rhythm. Now, what's fascinating is that the basic mechanisms are conserved across all life on Earth, but the genes and their protein products are slightly different. So all the animal line, that's invertebrates and vertebrates, build their circadian clocks in largely the same way. But the plants do it differently, the bacteria do it differently, the fungi do it differently. So I think what this tells us is this is a fundamental requirement of all life on Earth. And we've all done it in different ways, but boy, does it influence every aspect of an organism's biology.
Wow. Russell, I wanted to ask you, quite a while ago here in the interview, you talked about the fact that you don't necessarily need to get however many hours of sleep in a row, that if you wake up, you can just take your time, listen to music, whatever it is, go back to sleep. And I know people who just love their afternoon naps, and they don't worry about getting only 5 hours of sleep at night because they say, I'll just make up the other two in an afternoon nap or whatever it is. Most often we're taking afternoon naps when it's light outside, so maybe it's not the quality sleep. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, napping is really interesting. So the studies that have been done in the lab have suggested that about a 20-minute nap is about optimal. So it will perk you up for the second half of the day, but you won't fall into deeper sleep where recovery from that deeper sleep makes you sluggish and ineffective. The key thing about those short naps is that they shouldn't be too close to bedtime, because that will delay sleep onset that night, because it'll push back the sleep pressure. So occasional nap, you know, if it makes you feel better. Key thing is, if it makes you function optimally during the day, it's not a problem. If it works for you, then do it. As I say, one shoe size does not fit all. Where it does become a bit of a problem is in our teenagers. And I know this is a problem both within the UK and within the United States. And so what you've got is young people going to sleep very late. So their nighttime sleep is very short. So they're waking up, driven out of bed in the morning when they're half asleep, struggling through the school day because they're tired. They then get home and they may have a two or maybe longer sleep, which is relatively close to bedtime. That then pushes back the sleep pressure, meaning it's going to get more difficult to get to sleep that night. Of course, added with social media and all the other stuff that's going on in their complicated lives. And so one has to be careful you don't fall into a trap of shorter nighttime sleep and then longer daytime naps, because in a sense, what you're doing is you're not able to function during the first half of the day because you're running on empty, you're running on too little sleep. And that's what a lot of our bright young people are suffering from.
Professor Russell Foster has written Lifetime, Your Body Clock and Its Essential Roles in Good Health and Sleep. It's a very readable book. There's a lot of good research in it and diagrams. There's a lot of buzz about this book as well, Professor. And we really appreciate you being on Cool Science Radio. We have enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you very much indeed. I was based at the University of Virginia for 8 years, and I was a great fan of National Public Radio. So it's a great honor to be on your program.
Oh, well, and we'd love to have you back on too.
Thanks, Russell.
Jolly good. Thank you. Right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. We will be talking about the ultimate book of big cats. You know the ones, those mountain lions, those bobcats, when we return. Stay with us. And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Professor Russell Foster all about sleep. So fascinating. Our next guests this morning are National Geographic explorers, Steve Winter and Sharon Guinup. Their new book is The Ultimate Book of Big Cats, Your Guide to the Secret Lives of These Fierce, Fabulous Felines. The book shares never-before-seen images of big cats in their environments, including snow leopards, jaguars, leopards, tigers, cheetahs, and of course, lions. Sharon and Steve, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello, so nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I feel like as interesting as your book is the story of how you each became interested in big cats. Steve, why don't you start?
Well, I became interested in big cats on my first natural history story for National Geographic, because during that story on the resplendent Quetzal, working in the cloud forest of Guatemala, one night I was visited by a black panther. And I didn't know anything about big cats and had just started working in the natural world because I was a photojournalist. And then 3 weeks later, I actually saw the cat. The first time, all I heard was him walking up the stairs and then scratching under the door, then sniffing under the door. And that scared me to death. Radioed down the naturalist said, "Steve, don't worry. It's just a black panther."
And then he saw one, and so he made his next story jaguars.
And found out National Geographic had never done a story on the world's third largest cat.
And I asked him, "Do you think there might be a right reason why?" And it's because you really never see them except in one part of the world, which is along the banks of the rivers in the Brazilian Pantanal. And we just got back from another trip there. We got back last weekend. So Steve, you know, since has done two stories on jaguars. I've written numerous stories on jaguars.
And a TV show for Nat Geo Wild.
So that just kind of launched, in any industry, you get pigeonholed, right? It's like, oh, big cats.
They do cats,
right?
So yeah.
Then it progressed from there.
And Sharon, what was your story about getting interested in photographing big cats?
Well, I was a photographer through half of my career. And the last couple of years, I was strictly photographing. It was the science and environmental stories that really captivated me. I'd been really fascinated by animals ever since I was a little kid. I went to graduate school and I studied both science and journalism and became more of a writer and a producer. I also still photograph. But at that point, I really focused on wildlife, ecosystems, and environmental issues. And, Steve and I worked together a lot in the field. We produced a tiger book in 2014. I wrote it, his photos, and, it just progressed from there. I mean, the apex predators are key to every ecosystem they live in. So it was kind of very natural progression to look at big cats.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, thanks for joining us. We are speaking with Steve Winter and Sharon Guinup, who have written The Ultimate Book of Big Cats, Your Guide to the Secret Lives of These Fierce, Fabulous Felines. And Steve, I wanted to say you look pretty good. I understand that you had surgery on Monday, and you still were able to join us this morning. So we thank you for that, and we hope you're feeling better.
Thank you very much. His surgery was Sunday. They released on Monday. I'm doing really good.
Okay.
Well, because I'm always happy to talk about the fact that I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world, that I have gotten to live a life that I wanted since I was 8 years old, to be a photographer for National Geographic.
Yeah, and one of the things in the book is that you camped out for 3 months in India's Himalayas with temperatures plunging to 50 below zero to photograph the secret behavior of snow leopards. I mean, that's There's a lot of work that goes into being a Nat Geo explorer. Can you tell us a little bit about what you had to do to capture these photos and what you learned?
Well, with the snow leopard and many of the other cats that I first started with, they were the secretive cats, the ones that you won't see because they had been hunted in the past. Things have changed now. So I use remote cameras. I had to figure out how to use a camera that you place on a trail with an infrared beam. So I see this beautiful landscape, compose my picture, figure out where I want the cat to break the beam in my composition. And then once I figured that out, we went to the Himalayas, and I'm used to working in jungles. So 50 below is not something that I was really excited about, but luckily we went on a recce first, and I was very cold at night, and I vowed never to be cold. So I never was. And we got some extraordinary pictures starting after 3 days to be able to see how the cat comes to its marking locations. Males mark in certain locations with scent glands and to tell other males, this is my territory, not yours. And so we could start setting cameras in those locations. And we started getting images, not just images, fabulous images about how these animals live in the Himalayas.
There's one image of a cat rubbing its chin on a rock, exactly the way your house cat would rub on something. It's just fascinating. And, you know, just the background on that. I mean, you know, Steve had to go in with a whole team, you know, camp. The only warm place was the cook tent. It was like, I don't know, probably at least 50 bags of gear that they had to, you know, trek in on horseback. You know, it's really out there. You couldn't have paid me to do that expedition. But, you know, it really showed the world for one of the, you know, with some of the first images, you know, what the lives of these secretive cats look like.
So fascinating. Well, I'm wondering with the snow leopard, if it's more that the territory that they live in is pretty inaccessible by humans, or if they are really that elusive. I remember a book years ago, Peter Mathiasen, like something In Search of the Snow Leopard or something, and they really are elusive, but which is it?
I think it's both, frankly. You know, that book looked at the incredible field biologist George Schaller's work. You know, he spent a long time trying to, you know, look into their work as a biologist. And just one other thing that I'll add is that we could not do our work without field biologists and local people, because right, they know these animals. And, you know, we go in, Steve needs to set up cameras, figure out where to photograph, I need information. You know, it's the biologists and the local people that live beside and understand these animals. And it's again, the only way we can do our work is in strong collaboration with them.
And as far as local people go, I found that they were incredibly important because this is their home. They know their home, they know the animals, and they were able to help me find locations to place these cameras. Or throughout my career, they've been able to help me feel safe around many of these big cats that I work with.
I was curious, I was thinking a moment ago about if you live in the environment of whichever kind of cat or wildlife, do you find that people are, you know, fear them less or fear them more, Steve?
I think that depends on the cat. You know, snow leopards don't tend to attack people. Jaguars don't tend to attack people. Tigers, maybe lions, definitely leopards. I mean, there's animals that are more dangerous to humans. But, you know, all big cats, you know, they'll go after easy prey. So if there's livestock, if there's a cow or a goat or whatever around, they're gonna go for it. And that's people's livelihoods. So that's actually a really big deal. And that leads to a lot of conflicts and you know, people may then retaliate. And
it's always been one of the big things that I started working on from my first big cat story. that first Jaguar story was to try to find a way that people could benefit economically from not killing these cats. You know, so the first Jaguar story, I found every cowboy thought the only good Jaguar was a dead Jaguar, and every cattle death could be attributed to Jaguars. Well, we started a scientific study because the scientist I was working with in Brazil, her boss was my best friend. And we found out in the end, only 1% of cattle deaths could be attributed to Jaguars. In snow leopards, we started a program with predator-proof corrals. So we make corrals where they put their animals at night, where snow leopards and wolves can't get in them as long as they promise not to kill snow leopards. You know, then they found out that they're losing 30% of their herd to disease. Well, we bring in vaccine from USAID as long as they promise not to kill snow leopards. These programs are still going on. If you don't lose 30% of your herd anymore because of snow leopards, guess what? You love snow leopards now. Because you're making 30% more money.
Well, maybe 25.
Yeah.
Small amount of predation, but less, right?
But there's answers to every problem.
Sharon, what's it mean to be a Nat Geo explorer?
Nat Geo explorers are recipients of grants from the National Geographic Society that funds our work. And, you know, Steve has received many grants. I've received grants as well. You know, I also write for both, you know, Nat Geo Online and the website and the magazine. Steve has, you know, produced stories for Nat Geo for three decades. I lost track.
Yeah, a long time.
So, you know, we are part of a large group of people that include everything from, you know, journalists to scientists to cartographers to data people. I mean, it just, you know, it's a wide range of people that the society supports in research and media.
And Steve, digital photography is a game changer, and there's so many editing products out there that are so easy to use and to modify pictures, those sorts of things. It's fascinating to me that Nat Geo still has that policy that only raw images are to be uploaded, and I believe they still have that policy. And is that true?
Yes, it is true, and I'm very happy that we have restrictions on how we shoot and what we shoot. I was brought up that the frame that I see is the frame that is there, you know, and I always say that, you know, the composition is one of the most important things. When we go out from the first image we take to the last image we take, everything goes to the editor, all the mistakes in between, because we need to have a timeline of everything that's shot, whether we're out for 2 or 3 months at a time, you know. And shooting a raw image is very important to me, and that the image that I shoot is the image that I get.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, there's been very high levels of integrity in photography used in the magazine. You know, wildlife photographers are not allowed to bait animals. You know, there's all kinds of strictures, and, you know, or crop, as Steve mentioned. So in seeing the progression, you really see what happened. And I think it's just very, very important to maintain journalistic integrity, especially now when we see, you know, so many violations of that.
Right.
Absolutely.
And having rules are very important. It is very important.
So for those amateur photographers in our listening audience, Steve, what do you shoot with?
I shoot with like three different brands. I'm primarily a Canon shooter. Right now, I've just been working with the new R5, R6 mirrorless. I love it. I just love it.
It's lighter.
Yeah, and it's silent. But, you know, technology is very important to what we do. But in the end, it's all about that frame. That's why I tell young people that, you know, work on your composition, look at the masters of painting, because they worked within a canvas. I've never heard of a painter paint this beautiful big canvas and then go, well, I don't really want this part, and then cut it with a knife and get rid of it. Well, that's like cropping. You can always do that afterwards. I don't crop my images. National Geographic pays for them. They can do whatever they want, whatever fits within the story on the page. Yeah.
We're speaking with National Geographic Explorers, Steve Winter and Sharon Guinup. They're talking about their new book. It's a National Geographic kids book, but I'm telling you, it's really for adults too. It's the ultimate book of big cats, a big, beautiful picture book with lots of great stories. I wanted to ask you all, so on Nextdoor, you know, this social media site here in Park City, we have a lot of wildlife, and every day people are posting photos of moose and all that. But then there are lots of photos of mountain lions or cougars and bobcats, and people are very critical on Nextdoor. If you post a picture of a bobcat and call it a mountain lion, boy, you're going to get the comments. And so maybe for our listeners, you could talk about the difference between the two, you know, aside from that mountain lion's really long tail and the bobcat's bobbed tail.
Well, a cougar is a, you know, still a big cat, where a bobcat is a much smaller animal. And, you know, a cougar has its specifics. They're found from the Yukon all the way to Patagonia. And they have more names than any other cat in the world because they pass through so many indigenous communities that have different names for this cat. I did the first wild cougar story for the magazine also, you know, which ended up bringing about some change specifically in the LA area with urban cougars and the wildlife overpass.
But a really easy, you know, distinguishing feature, not only the size, is that, you know, bobcats are much fluffier, especially around the face, right? So, you know, cougars, mountain lions, whatever you want to call them, they have much, they're much less fuzzy. That's a really easy way to guess.
Bobcats have, you know, some spots and stuff also. But when you really look at a cougar and then look at a bobcat side by side in two pictures, you'll never mistake one for the other again.
Thank you.
Trust me.
That's great. And I also wanted to point out, when you were talking about the snow leopard, that tail is... so oftentimes as long as its body. Is that the same with the mountain lion?
I'm not sure about that. The snow leopard has the longest tail of any cat in the world. They use that long tail to wrap around themselves at night, and they use it for balance going down the steep mountains when they go after their prey.
So we spoke earlier about providing raw images to Nat Geo and not doing any cropping or editing at all. But at the same time, there are iconic photos that you all take that I'm sure show up in other people's brochures and things. They don't have permission, but these photos show up, and now they're being augmented and modified and those sorts of things. Has that happened to either of you?
It's not. There's been a couple of things that have popped up, but it hasn't been a huge problem. Frankly, mm-hmm.
People thought a lot about it more in the beginning of digital, but right now
everybody knows
that the Hollywood cougar picture is mine. So if somebody else posts it on something, they know that that's my photograph. So.
Sure. What has most surprised you both in your careers as you have staked out these long periods of time to catch certain photos?
Well, I think one of the most important things that has happened that hasn't really surprised us but has moved us is trying to make a difference with many of these projects. And one of the perfect example would be a project that Sharon started. I just did the video on it on investigating the Tiger Temple in Thailand. And she can talk more about that. But trying to have positive change.
I spent more than a year working with someone to uncover wildlife trafficking from a Buddhist monastery in Thailand that doubled as a tiger tourism venue, where you could, you know, pet cubs, walk adult tigers. And I did prove that. And within 4 months after that, running in National Geographic, the government was under so much pressure, international and domestic, that they shut it down. You know, there's been a number of things in our careers that there has been tangible change. And that's what we want to do, especially on this end of our careers. You know, that Hollywood cougar picture, you know, P22, who lives in Griffith Park in LA, became the poster child for the need for wildlife overpasses over those freeways that bisect any, you know, remaining habitat in Southern California. And the groundbreaking for the first overpass, which will be the largest in the world, happened on Earth Day. You know, Steve did pictures that helped create one of the world's largest tiger reserves in Myanmar. Although it's not fabulously protected, it's protected land. You know, there's not a lot of enforcement, but, you know, bit by bit by bit, you know, we're trying to make a difference. And, you know, Steve has done, you know, a couple of films. I've consulted on films. You know, we do stories. And now we're trying to expand that work. Actually, next month, we're launching a nonprofit called Big Cat Voices. And, you know, that is specifically to fund films and media projects, which gets harder and harder, you know, in this current media landscape.
Well, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you both. What a life and career you both have, Steve Winter and Sharon Guinup. Their book, The Ultimate Book of Big Cats, it's a National Geographic kids book that adults will love as well. Steve and Sharon, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. It's great being on NPR. We're addicts.
Good. So are we.
Okay. I listen to it in the jungle.
Oh, excellent. Good to know. Okay. Take care. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.